Good morning, members. I'll call the tax committee to order on March 11th, 2009, and welcome Dr. Wilson to the tax committee. Please join us, Dr. Wilson. Members, today is a day that is usually a pretty big day in the tax committee. It's something we discuss every 2 years, and that is the tax incidence report that I believe has now been prepared for 20 years by the Department of Revenue. So this must be the 10th, or maybe it's the 11th. Dr. Wilson can tell us, but This report, of course, it's a nonpartisan document brought forward by the Minnesota Department of Revenue, answers the question of who really pays the taxes. And so most folks have been on this committee for a while know that this information is usually something tax committee members are eager to look at and understand. So we want to have Dr. Wilson walk us through what he wants us to know today, and we want to be able to ask him questions. I should say for the public, the actual report is quite lengthy, and in the interest of conserving paper, that is not at the back for the public, although we can get it for anyone who wants it. Instead, what is provided is the PowerPoint presentation that really summarizes the longer document that Dr. Wilson's going to go through, and that is available in the back. And of course, all of these things are online at the Department of Revenue. So with that, good morning, Dr. Wilson. Nice to have you with us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here. I would make one comment on the online version of the incident study. It's a long document. The version that's online right now has no way to move around other than it's just one big document. Within a week, we will have ways to click on something and go directly to what you want to look for. So we have to get the document finalized before we go to the trouble to put that in. So, but within a week, it'll be a lot more user-friendly than it is right now. So. As the chair says, this is the 10th biennial tax incident study for the state of Minnesota. And the base year for this study is calendar year 2006. These are calendar year numbers, not fiscal year numbers. Calendar year 2006, and then we do a projection out to 2011, 5-year projection as well. I want to talk a bit today about what happened between 2004 and 2006. The results changed quite a bit, and the big question is why. And then also talk a bit about what is projected to happen between 2006 and 2011. Both are somewhat puzzles still. I'm not sure I have a complete answer for you, but I will give you as much as we know about that. The question asked, of course, this is a mandated study mandated by the legislature, is who pays the taxes. The studies include both state and local taxes, and local taxes, anytime we say local taxes, that includes schools and special districts, as well as townships and cities and counties. $22.1 billion were collected in taxes in 2006, and we estimate that the burden on Minnesotans was about $18.5 billion. Some of it is shifted, some of it paid by visitors to state or non-resident owners of cabins, for example, and some of it is shifted out of state in terms of the way we do the business tax allocation. Taxes will rise, projected to rise to $25.8 billion in 2011. I'll say a little bit more about that projection in a bit. The study includes both taxes on individuals and taxes on business. Defining what we mean by business tax, I think, is important just because there are many ways to define business taxes, and we've always had some problem with it. I will say this is an economic definition of business taxes, not a legal one. So taxes may be legally business taxes, but we're defining it with an economic meaning. The business taxes in this study, what we call business taxes, include the corporate income tax, all taxes on business property, including rental property, and any consumption taxes that are paid on products or services purchased by business or business use. So the sales tax the businesses pay on business inputs, the insurance premium tax the businesses pay on business insurance are considered business taxes. The individual taxes are basically everything else. All the individual income tax is considered to be an individual tax. There are some studies that say that try to carve part of that out and define it as a business tax, the part that's paid by S-Corps and partnerships and sole proprietors and maybe farmers. In the study, just keep in mind the individual tax is assumed to fall, burden falls on whoever pays it, so it's not included. We haven't carved that part out, although there are good reasons to do that for some other purposes. If we look at the taxes just quickly, and again, just to highlight a couple of things, the business taxes on this on the next slide, slide three. The largest business tax, of course, is business property taxes. If you include rental property there, it's over $3 billion of tax. That's 42% of the taxes that businesses pay in Minnesota. The sales tax on business inputs is the second most important business tax. If you include motor vehicle sales tax in the sales tax, and this includes some local sales taxes as well. 32% of the business, of what we call business taxes, are basically sales taxes. Corporate franchise tax represents 16%, a slightly small share to some people of the corporate, of the business tax total. And then, to the extent motor fuels are used by business, to the extent that mortgage and deed taxes are paid on business for deed, mortgages and deeds on business property, vehicle registration taxes on business vehicles, insurance premiums on business insurance, etc. Solid waste taxes, if they're really paid by business, we consider them a business tax, and we treat them as a tax. We have to figure out how to shift, how to figure out who bears the ultimate burden, because businesses may pass it on in higher prices, or they may not be able to. Business taxes make up, by this definition, 32.5% of the total taxes collected in Minnesota.
Excuse me, Dr. Wilson, as you're moving to individual, we have a question on the business, I think. Rustin West.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Wilson. And the 16% of total taxes paid by business being corporate franchise tax, has that held steady, or is that did that used to be higher?
Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, this was actually a fairly high year for corporate taxes in 2006, so it's over $1 billion. I'm not sure. That percentage of total taxes, of total state taxes, has certainly been higher in some past years. I haven't seen a comparison to business taxes generally, so I can't really give you a historical number, but the ratio of corporate taxes to total taxes has certainly gone down through time. Okay. My guess is it's true for business taxes, but I'm not. We have to look at the actual definitions and go back a ways to check.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Wilson. When you say that business taxes includes rental property, is that when a business is renting, say, an office or a commercial building to do business, or is that apartment building taxes that really would generally be paid by through the rent to the individuals who are renting in that apartment?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler. When I say rental property taxes, I really mean residential rental property taxes. The question of how much of that is borne by the renter as opposed to the owner is something we deal with in our modeling of the tax, but we don't assume that 100% of it is shifted to renters.
A follow-up to that, then, when we look at the individual burden, will that take into account their contribution towards that?
Mm-hmm. That's never said it, yes. The portion, part of that tax is paid by renters. Part of the sales tax on motor vehicles that businesses buy is also paid by consumers. Part of it is paid by the business owners. So we have a model of business taxes that actually tries to determine how to allocate those taxes, and I can say a little bit more about that. But it all gets allocated somewhere.
Okay.
And we're not talking about the burden on individual versus the burden on business. We're talking just about how to define the taxes to start with before we go through the ultimate burden.
Excuse me, Dr. Wilson, Rustin Bloom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Wilson, just a quick question. Does the business property taxes include the fiscal disparities tax that commercial industrial property pays?
Madam Chair, Representative Bloom, this business property taxes here includes everything that would be on a property tax run that you see from the House Research Office. So it includes all property taxes that are business property, all property taxes on that kind of run except for homeowners and cabins. Recreational student cabins. Individual taxes make up everything else, and again, we break some of them into two parts, and you'll see the amounts here. Clearly, income tax is the predominant tax among the individual taxes, and individual taxes make up a little over two-thirds of the total in 2006. The tax incidence study starts with a sample. Very important to create a sample that represents Minnesota well. We have detailed income and tax information for each of 105,000 households. We start with the income tax model that maybe you're familiar with, the HIT sample, and we add to that information from PPR filers who don't file an income tax, And we add to that also information from other sources to assign income to people who don't file either of those two. We have data on income, and the data on income is basically hard data. In other words, it's always data that we have actually connected to that individual. We don't impute any income to individuals. The income tax also comes directly from what they paid. The homeowner taxes we get from county records. The property tax refund, obviously, we get from the property tax refund return. And for the first time this year, the motor vehicle registration tax is actually a hard match directly to the motor vehicle registration files, so that we actually have the right tax there. When we did that, we found the tax was a lot more regressive than we had said in previous studies. So it actually was quite an improvement, I think, in the studies. I'll say a little more about that later as well. The rest of the taxes, we have to estimate the burden. And we estimate, for the custom taxes, we use a consumer census survey. We do very elaborate statistical work on that to come up with estimates of what the expected expenditures of various sorts would be, depending upon households. We divide households into 9 different types and run different regressions on each type. But we try to get the best measure we can. For other types of expenditures, we have to go and find other sources of data. And we use a lot of federal data on medical expenditures with working with health, the Department of Health also for some of these taxes. So the sample then is weighted to represent all 2.45 million households in the state. And then for most of our analysis, we divide it into 10 groups. We take the poorest, sort them from poorest to richest in terms of income, and we usually divide them into 10 groups, 10 deciles we call them. So each decile is their population deciles, at least we'll have 545,000 households. The lowest deciles, the lowest income 10% have incomes less than 9,782, and the highest income group 10% starts with those with incomes of $124,000. And we'll talk a little bit, I know some of you know about income deciles, we'll come back to that. Most of what I'll talk about is in population deciles to start with. Income in this study includes all money income. It's a very broad definition of income. We start with federal gross income on the tax return. We do not start with federal adjusted gross income. Those of you who fill out a tax return or will soon know there's a difference between the two. Most of the adjustments that are made between federal gross income and federal adjusted gross income are things that are not really a redefinition of income. They really are a way to give a tax break to certain people. The tuition deduction gives a tax break, and it may be appropriate to do that, but we don't want to take tuition deduction out from income. So we start with federal gross income, basically wages, et cetera, add those up as a starting point. We also include non-taxable income of various sorts, non-taxable Social Security, non-taxable pension income, non-taxable interest income, workers' comp, cash payments, cash MFIP or welfare payments, also GA and some other programs. And we also add back some other things too that are not directly on the tax form. Voluntary contributions to deferred compensation, for example, are considered part of income that you choose to use for that purpose. This definition of income is very close to what the property tax refund uses as its definition of income. It is also very close to what Congressional Budget Office and Treasury use in defining in their work on to simply use cash income. So it's a very broad measure. Keep in mind, sort of everything. And we do get income from a lot of non-filers, so we do get direct income. We get direct income measures. We may underestimate the income of some folks at the bottom end, but we do have a lot of information about their income as well. Things income does not include, we do not include any in-kind assistance, food stamps, housing, well, like Section 8 housing assistance, medical assistance. Again, keep that in mind when we look at the effective tax rates in the lowest deciles. That may be a reason why they may look like they're higher than are believable. We don't include most fringe benefits either. It's largely a case of not having information more than a theoretical reason. And we also do not pick up any payments for health insurance or medical care that come out of pre-tax accounts, because that basically reduces the income you report on your income tax return, and we don't have any way to capture that. It doesn't show up on W-2. So most health insurance payments, most of the health sector of expenditures is actually not included in income, given the way healthcare is funded in the U.S. But other than that, it's a fairly complete measure. We are missing, we do not include child support payments because we can't get the data. We do not include veterans pensions because we can't get the data. Neither party will share it basically with us, so we have no way to pick that information up. Couple other quick comments on the sample. This study has 2.45 million households. You look at the census, there are only 2.05 million households, so we got too many households, obviously. Our median income is $40,000, their median income is $54,000, and they have 2.46, almost 2.5 people per household, and we have roughly 2 persons on average per household. And the question is, did we do something wrong? What's wrong here? This leads to a lot of confusion by people looking at the results, because both definitions are correct. We define a household to be like an income tax filing unit. We throw all the dependents in if they have income as well into that household. But it's an income tax filing unit is the best way to think about it. If you don't file income tax, it's still defined that way. It's people who would be on the same income tax return, and any dependents are pulled back into that household as well. So dependents are not considered households by themselves. They should be, they're not put out there loose. The census says anybody who occupies a housing unit under certain conditions will be in a household. Four single people sharing a house, sharing an apartment or a house will be one household per census, but 4 for us. An unmarried couple living together will be one household per census, will be 2 households for us. And as a result, we have more households. I think it's the appropriate definition of household for this kind of work. But if you look at the census, particularly when you say, how can income be that low, realize the reason income is that low is primarily because our definition of household is different, and we got more households to spread the income across. Our total population in the study matches the population of the census almost precisely. It's off by about 50 or 60,000 households because we don't include part-year residents. We can't distinguish part-year residents very well from non-residents on the income tax return. So part-year residents out there, 50, 60,000 is about half the people who move out of state during the year, and the census counts half of them as being here, I assume, at any particular time. So that's the only difference between our population. We actually have higher income in census reports because we have a broader definition, probably, of income. And believe it or not, people often report more income to the IRS than they do to the census. Results 2006. This is the picture many of you are familiar with. Again, on the left-hand side, the first decile is the poorest, the lowest income, at least lowest income households. The 10th decile is the 10% of the population with the highest income. Off to the right, we also often show separate amounts for the top 5%, top 1%. Realize the top 5% is in the top 10% in the 10th decile. The top 1% is both in the top 5 and in the 10th decile. So there's some double counting, which is why we separated. It's not sort of an additional extension. The average effective tax rate in 2006 was 11.2%. That's actually down a little bit from 11.6% in 2004. And the pattern has changed a bit from 2004 as well. Again, notice that incomes are fairly low. The top income decile starts with $124,000. You may think that's more typical, and we'll see why you may think that when we look at different household types a little bit later.
Dr. Wilson, if I interrupt you, I think there's usually an explanation in somewhere in the larger document, but can you just, because I know someone is wondering, can you explain why the first decile looks the way it does? It always confuses people. If you could just talk about what's going on in the first decile.
I do have a slide on that.
Okay, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
And I don't want to, if I go ahead, I may not
go
back.
Nope, we'll just wait. We'll wait. Thank you.
I'll have to get the pages to help me. But I will address that question.
Okay,
it's
thank
a very important one. We basically say, for most purposes, disregard the first decile as being more data problems, or at least problems with using 1 year's income as a measure of ability to pay. I want to talk about how to summarize, specifically, how do we summarize a distribution of tax payments. Effective tax rate is just the taxes divided by income, and we often use the terms progressive, proportional, and regressive. And so just to think about this, the proportional tax is one, again, this is percent of income on the left-hand column, the left-hand side here, the deciles. If every decile paid exactly 11.2% of their income in tax on average within each decile, we would have a tax where the line looks horizontal. And it would have a Stoops index of 0.00. A Stoops index is just a way to summarize these, and I want to say just 2 words to introduce them, because Stoops index has become very important in terms of shorthand information on these. If we, and I know this is on one slide for you, but if we add an upward sloping line, this also has an average tax of 11.2%. But this is a progressive tax because the average effective tax rate, taxes as a percent of income, are increasing with higher income. So the higher your income, the higher your tax would be, if this really were what we're looking at. A progressive income tax, in other words, is upward sloping on a diagram like this. The Stoops index for this particular one would be plus 0.021. It's plus, meaning progressive. And it's pretty small, 0.021, but you can still see there's quite a difference in effective tax rates across here. A small change in soup means quite a bit. On the other hand, if you go to the regressive side, a tax with the same soup except the negative sign is a downward sloping distribution of the taxes, again, going from about 13% down to 10.8 or something like that. That would be a regressive tax. Again, regressive is not a derogatory term here. It's a technical term for just a tax for which the effective tax rate goes down as income goes up. And you could be more regressive than that as well. The red line here is the more regressive tax with the soup index about minus 0.063. Notice that going from 0.02 to 0.06, minus 0.02 to minus 0.06 is actually a big change, okay? And we'll see that that's the kind of a change that was made between 04 and 06. So it gives you an idea, when you talk about a change in the soup index, what looks like a small change, second decimal place, I mean, that can't mean anything, but it's actually a big change because of the way the soup index is measured. The soup cannot be greater than 1, cannot be less than minus 1, 0 is proportional, negative is regressive, positive is progressive. If we look at the results for 2006 then, the soup index is minus 0.053. Now this is a population soup index, and there are other ways to measure soup indexes that are causing some confusion, but in past studies we've used the population soup index, which uses these 10 points to estimate the regressivity. That minus 0.053 is the same as if we had a tax that actually had the slope of the pink line here. This pink line would have the same soup. One of the advantages of the soup index is you can deal with taxes that are not straight lines across the diagram. Clearly, our tax is progressive between the third and the fifth decile. The second tax rate goes up. And then it becomes progressive or almost horizontal a little bit per bit, and then it becomes regressive at the end, certainly regressive in the early deciles. How do you summarize that? The soup index is one sort of an overall summary for things, but it's useful to think about it as a downward sloping line. What would be the equivalent of that? How regressive is it? Can be visualized better by thinking of a sort of a straight line that gives you the same kind of results.
Pardon me, Representative Carlson.
Yeah, I have a question on your definition of when a tax is regressive. And the question is, do you build in certain other programs? When it comes to mind, for example, circuit breaker with the property tax. We all know the property tax is a regressive tax, but we do try to make it a bit more clear by bringing in things like the circuit breaker. So is that reflected in your numbers at all?
Measure of Bill Carlson, yes, that is, and you'll see those results later. We do consider the property tax refund to be a negative tax in here, so it actually is, so it's a negative, it offsets property tax, and we'll show the effects of that very clearly. We also, by the way, consider the working family credit to be a negative income tax, not income, but a negative income tax, so it makes the income tax more progressive as well. And we'll see that illustrated very clearly at the end of the presentation.
And Representative Carlson, I think, you know, and I have to admit, I kind of read ahead when I got the report yesterday. You make a great point, because if the circuit breaker did not exist, and some of the things that you and Dr. Wilson just talked about, the system would be even more regressive than it is now, and it is in the report. Dr. Wilson.
Another way to look at how our system just for the bottom of the before we ask the question about what happened between 04 and 06, think about the tax system. If you do a stacking graph, now what you have in your handout is the final of these four, but I'll go through them one by one here. If we were to just show the income tax by itself, the graph would look like this. Okay, the income tax rate, the effective tax rate for income tax in the first decile is minus 1.3%, and this is precisely because of refundable income tax credit. There's actually, on average, a negative income tax rate for the first decile and the second decile. Now, that's not for everybody in there, but on average, it's negative. The third decile pays essentially zero on average. And you can see it goes up then from there. The 10th decile is 5.4%, the top 1% is 6%. You might ask, don't you have a 7.85% tax rate? How can it be only 6%? The reason for that, two reasons for that. One is just that we've got non-taxable income included in the definition, so not all income is subject to tax. You've got itemized deductions, you've got exemptions, you've got other forms of exempt income. And of course, you don't pay 7.85% on all your income. You pay, start with the 5.35, then 7.05, so you're still not paying it on all of it. But it is sometimes striking that the average effective tax rate doesn't get as high as people might think it would. Obviously, the marginal tax rate is 7.85% for those people, but the average is quite a bit lower. The Fuchs Index for income tax is plus 0.194. Okay, this is what a progressive tax looks like. Plus 0.14, plus means it's progressive, and income tax makes up 36% of the total burden. Now we're looking at burdens here, not tax collection. So 36% of the total burden once it's dealt with taking out what is paid by non-residents. If we stack on top of that then the non-residential and the residential property tax, the beige or white section there is the residential property tax. In the second decile, and by the way, the reason for the dots from the first and second is because when you take the income tax down to minus 1.3, you've got to start from there when you stack your graph up. So it's going up all the way from the bottom of the blue on the first decile all the way up to the top of the white there. Just realize it's that kind of a stacking graph. We've got to overcome the negatives in the beginning. But the residential property tax after PPR is 18% of the total revenue in total burden in the state. The effective tax rate there goes from 1.6% in the second decile to between 2.6% of income and 2.7% of income in the fifth through seventh deciles, and then it goes down quite significantly down to 1.3% in the tenth decile and goes on further for the top five and top one. This is after PPR, and we'll see what it would not look like this if we didn't have the property tax refund program. But this is actually not progressive. You can certainly see regressivity. A lot of regressivity comes just in the 10th decile because it goes down there. It's progressive. It has a Fuchs Index of minus 0.148. That's one of the less regressive taxes among the regressive taxes in the state. But it's still a regressive tax because overall it goes down with income. The non-residential property tax, and again, rental property is in the residential property tax here, but non-residential property taxes, 7% of the burden, not necessarily 7% of the revenue, but 7% of the burden, is more regressive, and it's one of the business taxes that we'll talk about a bit, but it tends to be more regressive with a Fuchs Index of minus 0.190.
Oh, sure.
Yes, please, Dr. Lenny.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Wilson, could you explain what property is included in non-residential?
Dr. Wilson.
I'm Chair Representative Lanning. Non-resident property tax includes all, we're including the state property tax as well as local property taxes. And it's all of those taxes except for the taxes on rental housing, apartments, and homestead non-residential, homestead residential, and then homestead and cabins. Everything else is non-homestead, non-residential. So we found cabins are actually in the residential here. We do sort of move them back and forth, and you could define it differently. They're a small part of the residential part piece here. But, so it's everything except for rental housing and owned homes, basically, and cabins.
Okay.
If we add sales tax onto this, you begin to see, with just the income tax and the property taxes, you would actually see a system that was not particularly, but might even be progressive. I don't have a measure of it, but you can see what happens with the sales tax on. The sales tax is much more regressive than certainly the residential property tax after PPR or the income tax. And you can see that the share percent of income paid in sales tax goes up quite a bit, 4.9% in the second decile, 3% in the sixth, 2.4% in the ninth, 1.6% in the tenth, 1.2% at the top 1%. That's what begins to drive our tax system, making it more regressive. And if you stack on top of that, all the other taxes that are on the list, and you want to see a list of taxes, table 2.1 in the report is probably the place that lists the taxes best. I'm not sure which. Page 27 lists all the taxes. You want to have the list of all the taxes. We sort of went over those on the first couple of slides. But this is everything else. This includes sort of a hodgepodge of everything else that's in the tax system. And it's even more regressive than the sales tax. This includes excise taxes, it includes motor vehicle registration taxes, it includes mortgage and deed taxes. Minnesota CARES is in here, and a couple oddballs like the state tax is in here too, which is not a regressive tax, but when you put them together, it's quite regressive. So that's why we get the system we do. We have an income tax that gives some progressivity to the system. The property tax refund keeps the homeowner tax from becoming, or the residential tax from becoming particularly regressive, and then the sales and other taxes tend to make the overall result
on average or better.
Dr. Wilson, if I may, before you move on, okay, so the last slide was all the taxes together. And so that's showing when people talk about, if you hear people say, what is Minnesota's tax system like? Who pays the tax? This is sort of all of it now. And this is sort of for just the public to kind of think about when they hear us talking about this. Mm-hmm. This is the combined, while some taxes are progressive, most are regressive in varying degrees. Is that the right way to think about this slide?
Matt, that is correct. This is all the taxes that are, this is the total tax burden on Minnesotans that we estimate. So it's all taxes. It's the same, the top of this graph is the same as the earlier line graph we showed. So it's all taxes. It's the same results when you add them all up. Yeah.
And Dr. Wilson, I don't want to distract members to go off and page for the bigger document, yeah. But it's helpful for members of this committee bipartisanly to think about there is the incidence for everything. I think it's on page 57, and it's got every tax, you know, how regressive, how progressive. And we often get very good on both sides of the aisle here on using those suits indexes in debate on the House floor, and kind of people pull these out and fight them, which they should. I think that's accurate. That's the right way to think about it. You mentioned the renter's credit and the PTR and the income tax, and now you just mentioned the estate tax. Okay, so is the estate tax and the income tax, and then some of these credits that are going on to assist people, is that it for progressive taxes and everything else is regressive? I guess in my mind, I always have it that we really have two progressive taxes in Minnesota, income and estate, and then we've got some refunds and credits going on to assist parts, but are there any other progressive taxes besides the income tax and the estate tax in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, there actually are two other taxes that we show with a positive suit besides the estate and the income. One is industrial property taxes, and the other is the taconite production tax or the mining production tax. Let me just explain. Industrial property tax is only progressive because the reason why some other property taxes that are on business are regressive is because we assume quite a bit is passed on in higher prices to consumers. It's very hard for manufacturer to pass the price on to consumers. They are usually selling in a national market, so it's very hard for them to raise the price, and as a result, more of the burden is borne by the owners. It makes it a progressive tax, but of course also makes it makes it a difficult tax in terms of competitiveness. So I think you're better off thinking of the individual income tax and the estate tax as the ones that are progressive despite those idiosyncrasies. The share of the industrial property tax itself is, in terms of total property tax, actually pretty small, and the share that's formed by Minnesotans is actually very small too by this study. So it doesn't have much effect on the suits index or something like that. But technically those are progressive taxes in the way it's presented in the study. So you can be a progressive tax and yet still have major competitiveness issues on the property tax side because you can't raise the price.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The sales tax and all other tax, how do you calculate those, or what information sources provide you that kind of information?
I'm sure Representative Downey, for the motor vehicle registration tax, for example, we actually have real data on what's paid. Most of those taxes, though, we have to make estimates. For a lot of them, we use the Consumer Expenditure Survey, which is a national survey. It's detailed information on surveys that are done quarterly for five quarters. We combine 3 years of data from that, and then we do a lot of statistical work to try to find out how the expenditures on each of those types of expenditures, how they vary with income and with household type. So for those that we're trying to get it from expenditure patterns, we know about how much sales tax is paid on certain types of goods, and so we're allocating a portion of the sales tax by product, basically, or by service in some cases. For others we have to use other information, and sometimes it's not as direct as that. The mortgage and deed tax, obviously you don't pay a mortgage and deed, you don't pay a mortgage tax if you don't take out a new mortgage. So technically we ought to just assign it to people who just bought homes or refinanced or something in the last year. We don't have that kind of information. We allocate it to homeowners sort of across the board. So some of it is a little, I think on average it turns out fine, but we don't have hard data we're matching for some of these taxes. It is sort of the best estimate we have, and it, it matches the methodologies used and others by other people who've done similar kinds of work.
Dr. Wilson, could you just, as a follow-up, I think Rep. Santoni has more, just to put it in context for members, I mean, my understanding, and I know it's difficult for the Department of Revenue to toot their own horn here, but I'd like to try to help you. Really, Minnesota, I think, is, first of all, one of the only states that even takes a crack at this. And it's one of the most comprehensive approaches, and I don't even know who to attribute this good idea to, who came up with this idea that we ought to have an independent department answer the question, who pays taxes. Are you aware, are there any other states that you feel that are even competitive with Minnesota in kind of attempting to prepare this data for its legislators to sift through the information?
Madam Chair, there are no states that do this kind of study that I know of, at least on a regular basis. There have been states that do sort of one-time study. Some of them have done two. But it's certainly not a general practice anywhere else. There is work done. Some studies that do this study use there are a couple think tanks in Washington, D.C. that do this kind of work for states as well. And you'll see some of that data later on for some other states. But as far as I know, in terms of an every other year study, and by the way, some people have said, why do it every 2 years? Why not do it every 4 years? My own response to that is, if we did it every 4 years, we would forget how we did it by the time. We are not pushing. I think there's some infrastructure questions when you have a big gap between studies.
Dr. Wilson, I just, you know, please, I know Commissioner Ines cannot be with us, so if you pass on to him that, you know, we just continue to be amazed at his department's ability to produce this data, and we really do appreciate it. We've got to that point Representative Fulber, but we're going to go back to Representative Downey then, and then Representative Anderson.
Just for your information, I think it was Representative Paul Ogren that instituted this, who was chair of the tax committee then, I believe.
Okay. Thank you for that. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. All of these statistics, or the graphs at least here in the presentation, are percentage of income based, and I know I saw briefly that there's some tables of actual dollars in the bulk report. Do we have this in terms of kind of raw dollars per capita as compared to percent of income in graphical form, or would we have to kind of deduce that from the tables in the report?
Dr. Wilson.
My service has value. The data report is presented in a number of different ways. There are tables that I'll talk about in the back by household types. For example, married with children only, that will show you the dollars of tax paid on average by within groups of 10% for many of the individual taxes, more detail than we've got here. So you can look at what's typical for a homeowner property tax net of PTR, for example, for a married family with children in the seventh decile with a certain income. Or you can look at what we're assuming they pay in sales tax or what they pay in other ways. So that information is given in there in dollar terms. We'll see in a minute that there is also some places where the amount paid is compared to the amount of income as well. When we look at income deciles in a few minutes, you'll sort of see that contrast as well. But most of the work we've done is in terms of effective tax rates.
Dr. Wilson, we have Representative Anderson, and we have a lot of slides to get to. You know, there are chairs who actually, I've noticed this year, assign homework, and I think that's an interesting concept. And so I've never tried that, but I would just say that I would urge members, if there is one document, two things that as members of this committee you read in 2 years. One is to review the House overview that House Research presented to us in January, which they watch through all the big taxes, and that's so helpful. And this document, if you can find time to look through this, it affects all of us in so many ways. We base bill introductions on this data. It helps, you know, liberals make arguments, conservatives make arguments. I mean, it's sort of a basis for thinking through. I really would encourage members to familiarize yourself with this document. There's so much information here. You'd just be astounded. If you just even look at the table of contents on how many tables are in the document, you'd be amazed how much data our own department has provided for us to help make good decisions for Minnesotans. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Dr. Wilson, what happens if you take out, if you exclude the first decile? What happens to the Suits Index for the remainder?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, the Suits would fall to minus, it would fall from minus 0.053 to minus 0.044. Still quite regressive. Well, I mean, it's not a huge drop, but it is significant. I mean, it does make a difference. First decile is not sort of insignificant in terms of it. I mean, if you left the first decile in and you took out the tenth decile, the Suits Index would fall down to about minus 0.02. So the tenth decile is much more where the action is in terms of determining regressivity than the first decile. And that's more of a, it's sort of a technical issue that the Suits Index does. Since so much of the income is in the 10th decile, and the Suits Index is based upon looking at shares of income and shares of tax, it's going to be at the top where you have the biggest effect. So the drop from the 9th to the 10th decile is probably what's driving the regressivity overall more than the first decile.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Anderson,
Dr. Wilson, what happens if you take out the local tax portion of things and just have it strictly based on state taxes?
Representative Anderson, I'll show you a graph that the state taxes are roughly proportional, and the local taxes are somewhat regressive. So the net effect is what you see in the total. And I've got some slides in here, and there's things in the study, but we'll look at that. That's an important distinction to make as well.
Dr. Wilson, may I just say, I was just astounded to watch Representative Anderson ask you those two questions, and without even glancing at a piece of paper, you knew the answer. This is frightening to me that you knew to the 100th place decile the answer. Dr. Wilson, did you know that question was coming? Or?
Madam Chair, the real reason for knowing this is that when we saw the results of the study, we kept thinking we had done something wrong, and we've done an awful lot of work to try to figure out what's driving the results. So it may not be good news. But I know that. So.
Very impressive. Represent Garofalo and Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, thank you very much. This is great information. And Madam Chair, you had brought up some suggested reading for the committee. I actually have another one that I'd suggest to people, and that is at the end of session, the Senate does their, should just formulate like a Senate fiscal review that they give out. I forget what the formal title of it is. I'd recommend reading that for people, and just a suggestion to members of the House. If you're a geek and you read it cover to cover and you manage to find an error in it, don't call the staff and tell them in the Senate because they will get very upset and not like you. Just a little, should perhaps somebody here did that and they do not like that at all. So just a little tip. Madam Chair, I want to make sure we're having a complete and accurate picture of what we're talking about today. And I'm a little bit concerned because it seems like we're taking this data and, we're using it for the wrong purposes. We're making a correct statement, but using it for the wrong purposes. It'd be like saying, you know, last year, Tavares Jackson had a really bad year because he didn't hit enough home runs. Well, it's true that we're not looking at everything, and I'm hearing the term all taxes. Tavares Jackson was a quarterback for the Vikings. He plays football, in case anyone was wondering why it was wrong data. But I'm hearing the terms all taxes and everything being used. And that is not an accurate statement. If people are walking away from this committee today and they're prepared to say that those in the higher income quintets are paying a lower percentage of their income in total taxes compared to those in the middle and lower brackets, that is a false statement. And let me just repeat that. When you look at all taxes across all brackets that everything pays, the richest 1%, 5%, 10%, 20%, they all pay a higher percentage of their income in total tax burden than do the bottom 50, bottom 20, and bottom 10. And I'm concerned that members of this committee are walking away from this making that statement.
Representative Garofalo, can you just tell me what you're basing that on?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to.
Yes, please.
Because when I say all taxes, I mean all taxes.
Are you talking federal?
I include all taxes to government.
This is the Minnesota tax system.
Right, but that's not what people are saying. People have been using the terms all taxes and everything. This is not all taxes and everything. So, for example, when we look at the CBO analysis from 2005, which is the most recent numbers we have, all federal taxes, the lowest quintet, pays 4.3%. The highest quintet, the top 20%, pays 25.5%. They pay a 6 times as a percentage of income, which is the number we're using today. And if you look at the top 10, it's 27.4, top 5, 28.9, top 1 is 31.2. So anyone who walks out of here today saying that the rich are higher incomes or the successful pay a lower percentage of their income in taxes, it is simply not an accurate statement. And I'm concerned because I'm hearing people say this, and I think anyone who's going to be doing any research or statements on this needs to view things in the context that, you know, according to the general fund report, the forecast, I think about 25% of the money we spend in the state comes from federal sources. And I understand why the Department of Revenue can't put federal sources into this. That makes sense. But about a quarter of our government that we're paying for in the state is coming from those federal sources. And to exclude that revenue and to claim that we have a regressive tax code overall when we really don't, it's just not an accurate statement.
Okay. And there's about 6 people to that point. And I would like to just okay, so this is good. And this is going to be, you know, repeatedly on both sides for the rest of the session. And we want to get through this. So I just want to say a couple things because I want Dr. Wilson to respond to that. Because we really want to try to stay on the report and then we can all do our interpretations at a, you know, at a later time. But I think there's a couple things going on that Representative Garofalo is saying, yes, we should clarify, all should not include federal. We should say Minnesota. Because Minnesota has no ability to change federal tax law one way or another. So there are layering effects that are going on. But since we have absolutely no control over federal tax law, zero, other than calling you a member of Congress, this study is for what the Minnesota tax system does. So people can, I think that's appropriate for people to distinguish that. But all other Minnesota taxes are being counted. So I think, and then there's one other thing that the receiving federal money, that's getting into the finance side of the state equation. This is not, this report in this committee is not the spending side of the Minnesota budget, what we're doing here today. So when you start talking what the state, what the federal government gives in different spending areas, I mean, if they want to give the tax committee something, that'd be great, but they are doing spending in health and all these other places, but that is not incorporated here. And for our purposes for setting tax policy for the state of Minnesota, you know, that's not the role we're playing. But I think you've made a good point, and what does all mean? All means the state of Minnesota. And as state legislators, I think we really have to be honest. That's the only part we can control. We don't get to control the Fed. But I do want Dr. Wilson to just react to that statement by Representative Garofalo. So Dr. Wilson, please.
Madam Chair, Representative. I mean, I point well taken. We don't include federal taxes in the study. We also don't include any federal tax offset in the study. In other words, we don't take into account the fact that when you have higher state taxes, you pay lower federal taxes. If you itemize deductions, for example, for state income tax and property taxes. So the interaction between those two is it would be significant. But I think your point is very well taken. And we want to, sometimes in shorthand, we just say total taxes. I'm hoping in the context of the study, everybody realizes it's state and local, so not federal. I would say I did try to contact the second Minnesota senator, and I had trouble.
and if I may,
say on federal tax policy is less than usual. So.
And if to all the people who are trying to get in on that, would it be okay if we just kind of move on because we are not even halfway through the slide? So I think is everyone comfortable with that? Okay, so let's keep going and just kind of get out there, and we'll get better at saying Minnesota taxes. So, okay. Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, first decile problem was mentioned earlier. This is a slide on it. First decile has an effective tax rate of 23.8%, which seems really high and certainly looks out of place relative to other deciles. We believe, in general, the tax burden is overestimated for several reasons, or at least overestimated in terms of interpreting it in a normal way. Some people have temporarily low income. There are quite a few people, although it's certainly not the majority of people in the first decile, there are quite a few people who have negative incomes because of business losses who are down there temporarily. Because they have business losses, because we know they have quite a few assets, we allocate a portion of business taxes to them sometimes, that goes to business owners. And if you think about the effective tax rate, if you have zero income and you pay $10 in tax, your effective tax rate is infinite. Okay, 10 divided by 0 is infinity. So those people really do...
It's undefined.
Okay. But it's approaching infinity as your income goes to 0. But of course, the income is really negative. So if you calculate it, you actually have a negative effective tax rate, which is not really what you're doing. So thanks for the mathematical correction. In addition, we know we underestimate income in the sample for some people. Non-filers, we do get quite a bit of income for them. We know we don't have all of it. The Consumer Expenditure Survey shows expenditures for the very low end that simply are hard to believe relative to income, and we do make an adjustment for that, which has been supported by other work. But at very low incomes, it's very difficult to interpret an effective tax rate. And we should remind you that while we don't define income this way, so this is not a reason for not for saying there's an error in, or a mismeasurement, but we don't include in-kind income. If you are getting food stamps and you're living in subsidized housing, you may be able to consume a lot more than your total income, and so for that reason also. I would point out we also have some problems at the top, and we often talk about first decile. The top 1%, the high income problem, strange term, but anyway, the high income problem, we have some uncertainty about the amount that those with very high income actually pay in consumption taxes. Trying to figure out how much a millionaire pays in sales taxes on average is not something there's data for. The Consumer Expenditure Survey doesn't include a lot of millionaires, and in fact they cap incomes at a certain point. So there really is some uncertainty. We know what their income tax is, we have a pretty good feel for their income, and we know what their homeowner property tax is, but on some of the other taxes it's very difficult to get a clear answer. So I would give a little bit, be a little hesitant when you get down to a few people. In the income deciles, by the way, there are only 24 people in the top 1%. We'll see that in a minute. We don't know what people with $13 million are spending in sales tax very well. So I'd be cautious on both ends. But again, the 10th decile average is probably fine. But when you get to the top 1%, we have some questions there, too.
And Dr. Wilson, I'm going to encourage you to clip through them quicker because we adjourn in a half hour.
Okay.
We have a lot to go.
Okay.
Representative Cole has... Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Wilson, you mentioned that in the income figures, you don't include the in-kind income like food stamps and things like that. What about, are the refundable tax credits and other government transfer payments like Social Security income or things like that, are they included in income for the purposes of the study?
The refundable credits are considered to be negative taxes, so they're considered to be a negative tax rather than income.
At the beginning.
But Social Security, all Social Security is pulled in. Social Security is included even if it's, if you don't file an income tax return. We have records, we know it can match the Social Security income. So all non-taxable income that we can find at least is included. I'll skip over the next one. It just talks about which taxes are most progressive, et cetera. But just a word on income deciles. If you've got a pizza and you're trying to decide how to slice the pizza, when we used to make homemade pizzas, my son used to put all the pepperoni on one side and then he wanted to slice equal slices of pizza and he took the ones with all the pepperoni and I insisted we had to slice them so there was the same amount of pepperoni on each slice. That's sort of what's going on here. Population deciles have the same number of households in each decile. Income deciles have the same amount of income in each decile. And the important thing to know is that neither one is wrong, but population deciles give you more detail at the bottom of the income distribution, and income deciles give you more detail at the top. If you look at the green area, if you take from poorest to richest, and you take and you say the poorest taxpayers who have 10% of income, you just count all those, it takes 41% of the households to get 10% of the income, and as a result, you've got four population deciles sort of smushed into one income decile. On the other end, the top population decile has 43% of the income. So if you go to income deciles, you're splitting that 10th population decile into 4.3, basically more than 4 of your income deciles. So if you want more detail at the top, the income deciles are preferable. We want more detail at the bottom. We could divide this into many more. We could slice the pizza into a lot more pieces. But that's the main difference here. The results do look a lot different, though. This is the diagram for income deciles. Again, the first four deciles, population deciles, are shown in the first income decile. No first decile problem, right? Got four deciles in there, so the first decile problem goes away. And it's all downward sloping. You know, there's no question here that it's going down fairly, fairly constantly. So you get a different answer. And actually, if you calculate the truth on this, you get a different truth index too. And those are reported in the study, but we, for historical comparability, we tend to use population. They are, they're not going to give you different answers about relative progressivity and regressivity, but you do get a different calculation. All right, let's turn to some history and what happened between 04 and 06. If you look at effective rates from 1990 to 2011, we'll see that the effective tax rate went down from 11.6% in 2004 to 11.2% in 06, and then up slightly in 2011 in our projection. There's a footnote here. There's not much change here. There's a footnote here that says that the change in income, we changed the way we measured income by bringing in a little bit more income. With more income, your effective tax rates are going to go down. So 0.2 percentage points of that drop is really due to a redefinition of income. So really 11.6 to 11.4, I think, more accurate. The only way your effective tax rate goes down is if income grew up faster than taxes. So if income's going up faster than taxes, your effective tax rate goes down, and that's what's happened between 04 and 06, and we'll look at that to get a little further. Not a big story here, okay? So the next one, there's a story to be told. This is the SOOS Index by study from 1990, the first study that included the business taxes. And what you see is we used to be close to zero. And then we came to some years where it was quite far away, and by 2002 we were back up into a pretty getting close to zero again. And then it dropped this year to minus 0.053. These are kind of population decile SOOS indexes. The big question is why? What happened to drop the SOOS index by minus 0.029, to drop it by 0.029? And I want to make just a few points about this. I want to tell you that this is big. Okay, this is not a small change. The difference between minus 0.024 and minus 0.053 is not an insignificant change. The SOOS index changes that much, a lot is happening. Okay, it's changing the distribution considerably. We saw that by comparing some of the graphs earlier, the minus 0.06 to the minus 0.02 graph. The second point is that it's very difficult to find any tax policy that could do this, any change this big. If you look at what happened between 04 and 06, there wasn't enough to drive it, and I'll give you some illustrations of that in a minute, of what it would take to make this kind of a change. The third thing I would say is that between 04 and 06, almost every individual tax became more regressive by our measures. The only ones that didn't were ones where we changed methodology a little bit, and so there was another explanation for it. And the first thing I would say just to start is, the big question is, did we do something wrong? Okay. Is this a result of our methodology? Did we do something on methodology? Did we make some mistakes? And as I said, we spent quite a bit of time going back through this, trying to figure out why this was happening. I would say that part of the drop is due to a methodological change. When we measured the motor vehicle registration tax with a direct match to the motor vehicle registration file, we found that the motor vehicle registration tax was much more regressive than we had reported in earlier studies. That accounts for minus 0.04 of the minus 0.04 rather, of the minus 0.029. So part of this is due to a methodological issue. But you're still left with 0.025, which is a big change when it comes to SOOS indexes. The other thing to look at is to look at this pattern for a second and say, well, what else could be going on here? You look at the years where we have regressive taxes in the past, with more regressive years in the past. 1998, that was a sort of a boom year. 2000, also sort of a boom year. And 2006, at least for the benefit of hindsight, was a pretty good year for us. 2002 was a recession year, as was 1990, sort of. So it looks like there may be a business cycle connection. This was pointed out in a study 2 years ago that we think that while tax policy is extremely important, and I will emphasize that again, a lot of the changes year to year in the SOOS index are due to other things going on. I mean, it's the economy stupid is an answer to a lot of questions, and this may be one of them. We're trying to explain minus 0.025. You can't tell what this is really, but all I'll tell you is that these two series of numbers, the SOOS index on the top and whatever's on the bottom here, are very highly correlated. Like well over 90% correlation. It's negative correlation, but well over 90%. And what's on the bottom is the share of the top 1% of the population, the income share of the top 1%. And it's correlated with biggest year. In boom years, at least in recent decades, in boom years, the income distribution gets more unequal. In recession, you're going to get, a lot of people are hurting, but the income distribution tends to get a little less unequal. It's capital gains, it's stock, it's bonuses, it's all kinds of things going on. But the suggestion is made in the report that at least some of this is due to the business cycle, or at least to income distributional changes, which are not due directly to tax changes. We do have a table in there that shows the income shares 1990 to 2006. In 2006, the share of the 1% is 17.2%, which is almost the same as in 1998. The share of the top 5%, which would be the top two bars, is actually higher than it was in 1998. And as a result, I think while the interest study is very useful in looking at the impact of policy, don't forget that a lot else is going on in the world at the same time. As I said, no policy change large enough to explain this large change in the Foods Index. The mix in taxes changed it a little bit, but that by itself would have actually made the tax system less progressive, not more progressive, because actually the shift actually moved more toward progressive taxes away from progressive taxes. It takes a lot to move the Foods Index, okay? And here I just say again, minus 0.04 is due to motor vehicle registration, but we've got 0.025 to 20, and I want to shift down, and I'll come back to the last point here. Well, I guess I already said it. Every tax but one became progressive or less progressive between 2004 and 2006. How big a change does it take in policy to change the Foods Index by minus 0.025? Here's an example. If you raise the income tax by 10%, that's only going to change it by 0.009. I mean, that would be in the reverse direction pretty much, too. That's only 40% of what we would have to have what we saw in these 2 years. Raising the tax to top decile by 250 million, you're talking about a change around 0.006. Now, again, if you think about the other direction, but just in terms of magnitude, I'm not worried about the direction here, but just how big a change it takes in policy. Cut the sales tax to 6%, well, from 6.5% at least to 6%, and replace with a higher income tax, well, would replace the revenue, would give you about a plus 0.008, and again, much less than 0.025 we're trying to explain. Cut homeowner property tax by 20% doesn't do much. The Foods Index is hard to move, is the point here. If you increase the state sales tax by 0.5%, it's only minus 0.002. Gas tax by 5 cents a gallon, 0.002, negative. Cigarette tax by 75 cents a pack, 0.006, negative. If you eliminate the PTR, both renter and homeowner, and all refundable income tax credits, you get almost as big an effect, but not quite, as what we're seeing between these 2 years that hasn't been explained. So the point is, it is hard to explain this big a change due to tax policy. We have a lot more work to do to try to figure out. The beauty of the Foods Index is we can sort things out, but when every tax becomes more progressive or less progressive, including the income tax and the homeowner property tax, where we have hard data as well as the taxes we estimate using other methods, it seems to me that something is going on and that something is more likely to be income distributional than it is to be tax policy. So, we have more work to do in this, but that's the basic message. I don't have an answer for you. I certainly can't explain any tax policy that changed you that far. If we look at the change from 2006 to 2011, there it looks like not much is going on. Here are the two graphs. It becomes taxes fall a little bit in the deciles 1, 2, and 3. They go up in deciles most in 5, 6, 7, and 8. Foods Index hardly changes, minus plus 0.051. I'm sorry, the Foods Index should be negative. Do change that. It's minus 0.053 to minus 0.051, but not much change. A little more progressivity in the low end, a little more progressivity in the top end, and you end up almost averaging out. But don't let that mislead you. A lot is going on. The projection is based upon current law and, unfortunately, the November forecast, November 2008 forecast. We'll probably do an update for the February forecast if someone doesn't give us too many revenue estimates to do between now and the end of February. But I don't know that it would make a huge difference, but it would make some difference. But this is forecast, okay? So we're just looking at current law going out, but it doesn't include any law changes that have occurred since 2006. So the increase in gas tax, the increase in motor vehicle registration tax, the predicted increases in property tax rates, the levels that are predicted by in the forecast are all in here. The big change is that state taxes go down and local taxes go up, and it's big. Okay, the average state tax rate goes down from 8.3% to 7.9%. And question earlier about whether you just use the state taxes. The Foods Index in 06 for the state tax is only at 0.002. That's again with the PTR in it as well. And the Foods becomes slightly more progressive by 2011. But that's a pretty big drop, but it's more than offset for most people by the increase in local property, the local taxes, which is almost all property taxes. Local sales taxes are more than doubling over this period, but the money is in property taxes. Property taxes, the average burden in 2006 was 2.9%. It drops, it rises to 3.5% by 2011, the projections. The local share of our total taxes goes from 26.7 to 31.7. Now, that's a big change even over 5 years. And whether that will actually happen, of course, depends upon policy changes between now and then. But this is what is projected under current law. So a lot's going on. The big story between 2006-2011 is that state tax burden grows over those 5 years by 9.7%, less than the income growth of 15.5% over those 5 years. By the way, an income growth is also very low for a five-year period. Local tax burden grows 37.5%, 2.5 times as fast as income. You're talking about major shifts in the state and local shares. There are significant increases in overall shares of a bunch of regressive taxes over this time. Property taxes are going up and they're regressive. Motor fuel taxes are going up and they're regressive. Minimum taxes always go up faster than other taxes, and it's regressive. Local sales taxes are going up rapidly. Motor vehicle registration taxes going up as the caps come off under the grandfathering proposal. The combined impact of those three would have been to drop the Foods Index by another 0.013 from where it was in 2006. That's offset, though, by the fact that while those taxes are getting larger, a bunch of progressive taxes are actually shrinking in terms of the relative share. The sales tax share of the total expenditure of total revenue is going down significantly over this period of time. The corporate tax went down between those 2 years at least. Cigarette tax share is going down. Mortgage and taxes are shrinking. Those almost offset the increased regressivity of the other ones, which is why we don't see a big change in the regressive direction. The only reason we don't show some movement from 0.053 down further to 0.05, something bigger than 0.053 in the negative direction, is because a lot of taxes become less regressive or more progressive between 2006 and 2011, perhaps because of income distributional effects going the other direction from where they were in 06. But there's a lot going on between 6 and 11. It's not obvious from the first graph we looked at, which looks like the lines are almost on top of each other. There are big changes that are pointed out in the study. I want to quickly touch on a bunch of other things here that are in chapter 4 and 5 of the report. First of all, look at the variation within the deciles. This is by household type. Notice the first decile is made up mostly of singles who are either seniors or not seniors. They make up more than 70%. Of the first two and almost 70% of the third decile. We've got a lot of single people down there. Look where the married people are. The blue and white or beige are married and the light blue. Those three are married couples. The top decile is almost all married couples. Okay, and the real difference in this distribution, and one of the questions that I've always asked myself is, well, before I ask the question, I'll go on and look at this. The median incomes are real different too. The median income overall is $40,000. But look where the medians are. I love the white hair on the senior couples here. I mean, a senior couple and the single senior. So thanks, Mary Buechner in our office for her creativity on that. The family with kids, by the way, the couple with kids could have more than two or less than two, but it's just with kids. But the median income for family with kids is $81,000. The median income for a single senior is $23,000, including all the non-taxable income. It varies greatly, but of course no group has a median anywhere near 40,000. You're either higher by a lot or lower by a lot. And the question I had is that combining all family types and then just showing it as a household as a household as a household, sounds familiar to some of you. Doing it that way, are we messing up the results? Are we actually hiding something where maybe we're not? Maybe the piece is a lot different if we look at it whole in content. Now, some people try to make adjustments by household size, sort of based on poverty levels or something, and you can try to make those adjustments. We've actually toyed with them, but we haven't been very successful to do anything. Chapter 5 of the study contains separate tables by type of household. We take the married couples with kids, we divide them into 10 equal groups of 51,550 each. We have a lot of information on it. The effective tax rate falls fairly steadily from 14.6 to 10%, average 11.3, and their food index is almost the same as for the whole population. And we have them for other groups too. Married with no children actually is more regressive if you look at just those married couples. More regressive with a higher effective tax rate. Single people pay the highest effective tax rate and it's not particularly regressive. Seniors, not too far off, but lower effective tax rate on average. And single parents actually have a progressive. If all we had were single parents in the state, we'd have a progressive tax system. Not quite sure how we would finance it. Look at those tables. They really have a lot of interest. Secondly, how do we compare to other states? People are always asked the question, what do we look like compared to other states? There's a good study out there, 50 state study. It's dated. It's 2002. It doesn't include any senior households, so you can't compare it directly to our studies. It uses a different methodology for business taxes. It doesn't play include all the taxes we do for each of the states. It divides the population into 7 groups instead of 10 or whatever, and so we refer to it as a 7-point tooth index. So we do give some information on this, and what you find is tremendous variation across the state. Washington is the most progressive at -0.259 or something. It's almost a vertical, and it's not vertical, it's a pretty steep line on the graph. And there are a few states that have progressive systems. Minnesota, there are 10 states that look more regressive, less progressive than Minnesota for that year. In our study, and there are 39 states that look more regressive. I think it's important to keep that in mind. This is a table that's in the chart, and the cover always in the report that, look at, this is our surrounding states. You'll see South Dakota at the bottom, lower taxes, effective tax rates, but also very regressive. The interesting thing with the green one is Wisconsin. They have, according to the study, higher effective tax burden throughout most of the population, but they drop off on the top 1% below Minnesota. It's an interesting rate result to think about. And there's some other, the whole table in there of every state and what their system is, it really is an interesting comparison among the states. The study is cited and it's available online, so if you want to see it, it's very pretty color printing, stuff we can't afford to do. What keeps the Minnesota tax system relatively less regressive? The main thing is our income tax. It's a higher share of state and local taxes and revenue than in all but 7 other states. If we just change our tax mix to the all-state average, if that's all we did, we just leave our structures the same, but just change proportions, our system would drop from 0.05, -0.053 to -0.088, become significantly more regressive. Income tax is the thing that keeps us there. The 7 most progressive taxes are the states. 7 most progressive states are the 7 are the states without an income tax. They're all at the bottom because you can't have anything but a very progressive tax if you don't have a tax system unless you without an income tax unless you have a lot of oil revenue like Alaska. Income tax is also progressive in Minnesota. If we went to a single tax rate, leaves everything the same, but just go to one rate instead of the 3 rates, to be revenue neutral, 56.59% in 2006, and that would drop the tooth index by, you know, a lot. 0.018, again, we know that's large in terms of its impact. You're transferring all the income gets transferred to the top 5% of the population of households, basically, in doing that. The 7 most regressive states in the country in that study didn't have income tax, and the next 3 have flat taxes, one single rate, Pennsylvania, Alabama, and Illinois. I think Michigan's also down there with the single rate. Single rate taxes don't give you the kind of results that we see in Minnesota for better or worse. And finally, refundable credits in the PTR. Without them, the tooth index would be -0.075. More details are shown in Chapter 4 of the study on that. I do have a couple of charts here just showing what the refundable credits do to the income tax that are in the study and you can look at, but it has a significant impact, obviously, as does the PTR on residential property taxes. This is the brown is with the PTR. You can see what the PTR does. It makes the system look much different than it does if you didn't have them. If you didn't have the PTR, the residential property tax would be more regressive than the sales tax. So it would be among our larger. Just a couple quick comments. Other than Chapter 4, the health impact fee is not in the study. Now, I know that some would argue it should be in the study. It was not in the study last time in the projections. There is an appendix for one page that gives you all the numbers for income deciles and population deciles. If anyone wants to add it to the study and put it in and calculate the numbers showing it, it would reduce the suits index by, as we saw before, 75 cent increase in tax by 0.006, so it would go down to -0.059. It's not in there. It's definitely the fee. It's a fee defined here. Legislative is defined as a fee, yet it looks a lot like a tax. So it's information is given for you, but it's not in the study, and keep that in mind. When I said nothing much happened between 04 and 06, this is one thing that did happen between 04 and 06. Why do population deciles, income deciles, and full sample suits differ so much? We'd rather use the full sample suits. We cut the suits using every observation, all 105,000. We can do it quickly. We like them better. They're more accurate, etc. But we don't have historical data, and if we try to do that, it will make the things look more regressive relative to the history, and it's just misleading. And so we report them, but most of the study is based on population deciles. A couple times we've told the committee that you should not use results of the study to estimate the impact of a change in business taxes, because the incremental incidence of a change in business taxes is different than the average incidence reported in the report. The report assumes all states levy their taxes sort of simultaneously, and we look at how our tax is relative to other states, and that affects how the burden is distributed. If the tax is the same everywhere else, capital can't run to another state to avoid it. But if we change our business taxes, you'll have a much different effect, because the other states are presumably being held constant at that time. They give recommendation. There's some discussion in the text of some examples of how large the effect is. We can do incremental analysis. And someone said, you actually saw, this committee at least, you saw one slide based on incremental analysis, which was the repeal of the corporate income tax. That was based on incremental analysis with some limitations. And finally, what about the federal tax offset? We don't put it in, but in Chapter 4, it shows you diagrammatically what would happen if we took into account the deductibility of some state and local taxes on the federal income tax return. And for that, that's in there. It shows incremental versus average. And if you want to talk about the impact of change in business tax, you need to have us do a different analysis. Don't use what's in the study.
And Dr. Wilson is coming back on a different item as it relates to explaining revenue estimates, dynamic modeling, all this other stuff later. And I know so many people here have questions for you personally, so I encourage all members to contact Dr. Wilson. You'll find him very easy to work with. And thank you so much for an excellent report, and we are adjourned.
Thank you.